15. The Hidden Face. One day that September, the undercover operative who was pretending to be an insurance salesman stopped at a filling station in Fairfax and struck up a conversation with a woman working there. When the operative told her that he was looking to buy a house in the vicinity, she mentioned that William Hale controlled everything in these parts. She said that she'd purchased her own home from Hale, which was on the edge of his pasture. One night, she recalled, thousands of acres of Hale's land had been set on fire. Nothing was left behind but ashes. Most people didn't know who had started the blaze, but she did. Hale's workers, on his orders, had torched the land for the insurance money, $30,000 in all. White tried to learn more about another suspicious matter. How had Hale become the beneficiary of Henry Roan's $25,000 life insurance policy? After Roan turned up with a bullet in the back of his head in 1923, Hale had the most obvious motive. Yet the sheriff had never investigated Hale, nor had other local lawmen, an oversight that no longer seemed incidental. White tracked down the insurance salesman who had originally sold Roan the policy in 1921. Hale had always insisted that Roan, one of his closest friends, had made him the beneficiary because he had lent Roan a lot of money over the years. But the salesman told a different story. As the salesman recalled it, Hale had independently pushed for the policy, saying, "Hell's bells, that's just like spearing fish in a keg." Hale had promised to pay an extra premium on such a policy, and the salesman had responded, "Well, we might write him for $10,000. "No, I want it for $25,000," Hale said. The salesman had told Hale that because he wasn't Roan's relative, he could become his beneficiary only if he were his creditor. Hale had said, "Well, he owes me a lot of money. He owes me $10,000 or $12,000. White found it hard to believe that this debt was real. If Roan had really owed Hale that amount of money, then all Hale would have had to do was present proof of the debt to Roan's wealthy estate, which would have reimbursed him. Hale had no need to get an insurance policy on his friend's life, a policy that wouldn't have a significant return unless Roan, who was then in his late 30s, suddenly died. The salesman, who was close to Hale, admitted that he had no proof of the debt and that he had simply desired his commission. He was yet another person bound up in the Indian business. Roan seemed to have been unaware of these machinations. He trusted that Hale, his supposedly closest friend, was helping him. But there remained one impediment to Hale's scheme. A doctor had to examine Roan, a heavy drinker who had once wrecked his car while intoxicated, and deem him a safe risk for the insurance company. Though one physician said that nobody would approve that drunken Indian, Hale shopped for doctors until he found a man named Pawhuska willing to recommend Roan. One of the seemingly ubiquitous Schoen brothers, James, also recommended Roan. White discovered that the insurance company had rejected the first application. A company representative later noted dryly of Hale's effort to secure a $25,000 policy, "I don't think it would seem regular." Undeterred, Hale approached a second insurance company. The application asked if Roan had previously been turned down by a competitor. The answer, "No," was filled in. An insurance agent who reviewed the application later told authorities, "I knew the questions in it had been answered falsely." This time, Hale had produced a creditor's note to prove that he was owed money by Roan. The debt that Hale had originally claimed, $10,000 or $12,000, had grown inexplicably to $25,000, the exact amount of the insurance policy. The creditor's note was purportedly signed by Roan and was dated J.A.N.Y. 1921. This was important because it indicated that the note predated efforts to obtain the insurance, giving legitimacy to Hale's claim. Handwriting and document analysis were emerging tools in the field of criminal investigation. Although many people greeted the new forensic sciences with reverence, attributing to them a godlike power, they were often susceptible to human error. In 1894, the French criminologist Bertillon had helped to wrongfully convict Alfred Dreyfus of treason, having presented a wildly incorrect handwriting analysis. But, when applied carefully and discreetly, document and handwriting analysis could be helpful. In the infamous Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb murder case in 1924, investigators had correctly detected similarities between Leopold's typed school notes and the typed ransom note. Agents working on Roan's murder case later showed the creditor's note to an analyst at the Treasury Department, who was known as the Examiner of Questioned Documents. He detected that the date initially typed on the document had said June, and that someone had then carefully rubbed out the U and the E. Photographs taken by means of slanting light show clearly the roughening and raising of the fibers of the paper about the date, due to mechanical erasure, the examiner wrote. He determined that somebody had replaced the U with an A and the E with a Y so that the date read J-A-N-Y, January. White suspected that Hale had ginned up the document while trying to obtain the insurance policy, and altered it after realizing that he had blundered on the date. Later, a federal official questioned the man who Hale claimed had typed up the note. He denied ever having seen the document. Asked if Hale was lying, he said absolutely. The second insurance company approved the policy after Hale took Roan to the Pawhuska doctor again for the required medical examination. The doctor recalled asking Hale, "Bill, what are you going to do, kill this Indian?" Hale, laughing, said, "Hell yes." After Hale served as a pallbearer at Roan's funeral, White learned, local lawmen did more than ignore Hale as a suspect. They tried to build a case against Roy Bunch, the man who'd been having an affair with Roan's wife. White and his agent spoke to Bunch, who maintained his innocence and told a curious story about Hale. After Roan's murder, Hale had approached Bunch and said, "If I were you, I'd get out of town." "Why should I run? I didn't do it." "People think you did," Hale said. He offered Bunch money to help him flee. Afterward, Bunch spoke to a friend who persuaded him not to take off because it would only make him look guilty. "If you run, they'll hang it on you for sure," his friend said. White and his men thoroughly investigated Bunch and ruled him out as a suspect. As one agent noted, the notorious relations between Bunch and Roan's wife were calculated to furnish a good screen for the real murderers. And the person who seemed most intent on framing Bunch was the king of the Osage Hills. After Roan's murder, Hale had visited Roan's widow several times to try to get her to sign various papers regarding claims against Roan's estate. Once, Hale had left a bottle of whiskey for her as a gift, but she refused to taste the moonshine. She feared that it was poisoned. Though White had gathered circumstantial evidence implicating Hale in the murder of Roan, there were still huge holes in the case. There was no proof, no fingerprints, no credible eyewitnesses, that Hale had shot Roan or that he had ordered one of his nephews or another henchman to do so. And while the suspicious life insurance policy seemed to tie Hale to Roan's murder, it did not provide a motive for the other Osage killings. Yet, as White studied the Roan case further, one detail stood out. Before Hale obtained the life insurance policy on Roan, he had attempted to purchase Roan's headright, his share in the tribe's mineral trust, which was more precious than any cash of diamonds or gold. Hale knew that the law prevented anyone from buying or selling a headright, but he'd been confident that lobbying pressure from influential whites would soon eliminate this prohibition. Indeed, Hale once said, "I, like many other good men, believed it would be only a short time until Congress would pass a law permitting every educated Indian who had his certificate of competency to sell or convey his or her mineral rights to whom they wished." Yet the law had not been changed, and White suspected that this setback had prompted Hale to turn to the insurance murder plot. There was one legal way, though, that someone could still obtain a headright: inheritance. As White examined probate records for many of the murder victims, it was evident that with each successive death, more and more headrights were being directed into the hands of one person, Molly Burkhart. And it just so happened that she was married to Hale's nephew, Ernest, A man who, as an agent wrote in a report, is absolutely controlled by Hale. Kelsey Morrison, the bootlegger and bureau informant, said to agents that both Ernest and Brian Burkhart did exactly what their uncle told them to do. Morrison added that Hale was capable of anything. White studied the pattern of deaths in Molly's family. Even the chronology no longer seemed haphazard, but was part of a ruthless plan. Anna Brown, divorced and without children, had bequeathed nearly all her wealth to her mother, Lizzie. By killing Anna first, the mastermind made sure that her headright would not be divided between multiple heirs. Because Lizzie had willed most of her headright to her surviving daughters, Molly and Rita, she became the next logical target. Then came Rita and her husband, Bill Smith. White realized that the unusual method of the final killing, a bombing, had a vicious logic. The wills of Rita and Bill stipulated that if they died simultaneously, much of Rita's headright would go to her surviving sister Molly. Here, the mastermind had made one miscalculation. Because Bill unexpectedly outlived Rita by a few days, he had inherited much of her wealth, and upon his death, the money went to one of his relatives. Still, the bulk of the family's headrights had been funneled to Molly Burkhart, whose wealth was controlled by Ernest. And Hale, White was convinced, had secretly forged an indirect channel to this fortune through his subservient nephew. As White later reported to Hoover, Molly appears to have been the first means to draw Hale through the Burkharts, the assets of the entire family. White couldn't determine whether Ernest's marriage to Molly 4 years before Anna's murder had been conceived from the outset as part of the plot, or if Hale had prevailed upon his nephew to betray her after they married. In either case, the plan was so brazen, so sinister, that it was hard to fathom. It demanded that Ernest share a bed with Molly and raise children with her, all while plotting and scheming against her family. As Shakespeare wrote in Julius Caesar, "Where wilt thou find a cavern dark enough to mask thy monstrous visage? Seek none conspiracy, hide it in smiles and affability."